Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 176. I'm recording it on Wednesday, October 7th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 19. That's better than what we had before the crash, but not too exciting for stock investors. The title of the musical selection is Goofball. The title of the podcast is The Investment Strategies Explored at PassionSaving.com Would Not Have Been Possible Without the Work Done by the Passive Investing Advocates. This podcast is intended as a sort of taking stock podcast, and it reaches sort of in two directions. I'm going to sum up where we stand today in, you know, it's been 7.5 years, the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate, and we've come up with some amazing insights. And sum up where we stand, and I wanted to do two things. One, I want to sort of pat ourselves on the back. All of us who have worked to develop these investment insights deserve a little pat on the back. I think it's fair to say that I'm the leader of the effort, co-leader with John Walter Russell. He does the research, and I try to push things forward by asking lots of annoying questions. But we've had hundreds of people make contributions, important contributions, at all the various boards and blogs. And I can't give a list of all those people, but there's hundreds of them. Thousands who have expressed the desire that honest posting be permitted on the internet on investment questions. And we've come up with some amazing stuff, and I'm going to start the podcast off by describing the most powerful insight of all, which is one that I've been developing in recent podcasts. And part of the reason I record these, I want to share, but part of it is to develop the ideas. Speaking out loud sometimes helps me to think things through more carefully, and I'm in awe, frankly, of this most recent insight. It frightens me. It's so big, and I don't frighten easily. I've made some bold, provocative statements over the past 7 years. But this last one is so big that it does frighten me. And it's bigger than what my little shoulders can bear. The weight of it is bigger than what I can bear. And, the proper thing is that we should have, I don't even want to say thousands, we should have millions of people discussing these insights, because that's how big they are. That's how important they are to the future of the United States economic and political system. And boy, I remember once upon a time, this was several years back, there was a fellow who was writing up an entry on me. It wasn't for Wikipedia, but it was a Wikipedia type. It was like an internet dictionary or something. And somebody had put up Hokomania. I think it was John Graney. And, you know, they were putting it up as a mocking reference. And this guy was correcting it and saying, well, you know, this is abusive. This is inappropriate. But he said, the story is, he said, I follow these boards where this fellow, Rob Bennett, posts, and he has some grandiose ideas. And I in one hand, I thought it was sort of funny because he was a straight shooter. He was not abusive. He was correcting the abusive people. And I didn't know quite how to respond to that grandiose thing, because I said, yeah, they are grand. The ideas are grand. I don't think they're grandiose, because that suggests the false grandness. But they are grand. He's right about that. Maybe the problem people have with them is that they're just so big that people can't swallow them. I think it's partly that they're so big and partly that they're so good. And people just can't accept. You know that Paul Simon song, Something So Right? When something goes so well that you just can't let it in. It would just make you so happy to acknowledge the reality that you just can't let it in. That's a strange, strange human phenomenon, but I think that's what we're dealing with. But he didn't know grandiosity, did he? This was, I don't know, 4 years back probably. So he didn't know the half of it. We've gone way beyond that. way beyond where we were then. So on the one hand, I just want to sum up and say, okay, this is where we are, you know, at the end of 7.5 years. But I want to do two other things. As I say, I want to expand, of course. I've wanted to expand. I wanted to have open discussion. But, you know, I want to have, you know, I want to make peace with the passive investing advocates because we need them. You know, John Bogle has contacts at the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and all these things, and we need his help to move forward. If John Bogle were to make it his standard speech to advocate rational investing and to apologize for the mistakes made during his advocacy of passive investing, investors would hear that. That would be news. That would make a difference, and we need that. And I've written to John Bogle, and you know, you can see the email there at my website, but he has not responded as of today. But we need his help, and we need the help of others. So I want to always reach out the hand of friendship to John Bogle and Bill Bernstein and Scott Burns and Jonathan Clements and on, but at the same time, I don't want to do anything to disparage the work we have done in the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities. I view this as the most important work that has been done in the personal finance field in my lifetime. Grandiose as that may sound, that is my sincere take. And I don't intend to apologize one second for the work that we've done together. I've done that work, but I haven't done all of it. It's not one guy sitting in a room thinking grand thoughts. And I will not, you know, if we are wrong, I will apologize and I will acknowledge the error. God, you know, I hope, I pray. But I will not apologize unless, you know, we can find something that was wrong. And as of today, no one has found anything of any significance. I'm certain that there are things we got wrong. No one can do the amount of work that I have done and John Walter Russell has done and the others have done without having gotten something wrong. But I don't think we're wrong about the central stuff. I don't think we're wrong. I mean, we've been proven right about safe withdrawal rates. Even leading passive investing advocates, Larry Swedro is a big-time passive investing advocate, and he now describes the old-school safe withdrawal rate studies as garbage in, garbage out research. So, you know, that one was proven. And the rest, you know, different levels. I have different levels of certainty, different levels of confidence in the other insights. But you know, they all sort of followed. They all sort of followed. You look at the mistakes that were made in the passive investing model with the safe withdrawal rates, and then you just work from that and build a new model. And that's where we are. So on the one hand, I want to, the primary intent of the podcast is to say, look, thanks guys and girls. You know, we wouldn't be here today. None of this would be possible. We've done, you know, this was my dream. I remember that day I was sitting, I don't know, how old was I? I think I was 23, if I have this right, if I'm thinking properly. Let me think. I'm going to have to think it through. I started law school at 20, so I finished law school, I think, at 23, and then this was 2 years later, so I would have been 25, I think, when I started working at Daily Tax Report, and I wanted that job, and I applied for that job, and I had been out of work. It was a recession. I'd been out of work for some time, and I didn't want to be in a law job. I wanted to be in a journalism job, and I just, you know, it was finance, taxes, and covering Congress, and I just, you know, I wasn't a church-going person, but I prayed. I remember sitting out there. It was winter. I think it was February, but it was a sunny day. One of those sunny, every now and then you get like a 70 degree day. And just praying, you know, just saying, God, this is what I was meant to do. Please, you know, please, God, get with it. And you know, the goal, I followed Watergate. The goal was, you know, to come up with a big story. This is the biggest story of my lifetime in the personal finance field, at any rate. And it's been a painful experience, but I'm right in the middle of it. And I hope we're going to see good things come of it. I believe we are. And so, you know, we need all these people. We, you know, the idea here is not to say, nah, nah, nah. You know, we were right, you were wrong. That's obviously foolish and childish. And that's not the idea. And so the point of this podcast is to make a sincere presentation that these people helped us. At the other side, I do want to stay honest, which means, yes, the passive investing model is a mistake, and it has caused great human misery, and that's part of the story. That's just part of the honesty of it. And, so there's a little bit there in there's a tone in the title here. The investment strategies explored at PassionSaving.com would not have been possible without the work done by the passive investing advocates. Well, that is that's offering the hand of friendship. I'm saying, look, none of this would have been possible. But clearly there's a hint there of superiority that, I am saying we're right. And by implication, they're wrong. So, but you have to. Because if you don't do that, we're never going to make that change. What I've seen at a number of places in recent years, I remember this very clearly at the Money Bloggers Network, where I did a thread, might have been this past February or March. And there was a thread there, and people were very friendly to me, and I was describing valuation-informed indexing, and they thought it was just great. But there was this undercurrent where they'd say, well, Rob, you don't have to say passive investing is wrong. That's a form of passive investing. You only change your allocation every 10 years or so. That's a form of passive investing. I say, well, no, that's not passive investing. It's the opposite of passive investing. Passive investing says you don't need to change your allocation. This says you have to. No, Rob, once every 10 years, that's passive. I say, no, not passive investing. They threw me off all the boards where there were passive investors. They wouldn't have thrown me off if I was agreeing with them. That wouldn't make any sense. Oh, Rob, yes, it is. It's passive investing. And then, no. And then I said, well, all right, we're going to throw you off too then. If it's not Pat, there was no objection to the content, no objection to the ideas, no objection to looking to the historical data to learn how to invest effectively. The objection was that I was, bold enough to point out the obvious reality that an investing model that says you must change your allocation in response to price increases is not the same thing as one that says you must not change your allocation in response to price increases. That the two are opposites. They're not the same. And that was the only objection. And I think that's true of many places. That the problem is not that these ideas, no one has found significant flaws in the ideas, but on top of that, I don't think people really even dislike the ideas. They think the ideas are just fine, except they don't want to either admit that they were wrong or that others were wrong. They don't want any public statement that passive investing was a mistake. And I don't see how we get, if there were a way to pull it off, I would say fine to that. I don't care. Except I don't see how you can advocate one thing for 30 years and then switch and advocate the opposite without ever having acknowledged that you got something wrong. It just seems impossible to me. What are we going to do? We're going to take all those safe withdrawal rate studies that have caused millions of failed retirements and we're going to, put them down the memory hole like in 1984? This does not seem realistic to me. So implicit in that title, or maybe not, maybe it's explicit, is a suggestion, better to say suggested, that's the right word. There's a suggestion of superiority, and that's intended. Not so much that, I don't want to say I'm superior. I'm not superior. But there are good ideas and there are bad ideas. The rational investing ideas are the good ideas and the passive investing ideas are the bad ideas. But, so there are good strategies and there are bad strategies. The rational investing strategies are the good strategies. The passive investing strategies are the bad strategies. So there is a suggestion of superiority, which is intentional, because I think it would be dishonest not to let my listeners know that one approach is superior to the other. But there's also, both a charitable and an honest recognition. It's a charitable recognition, but it's honest. It's accurate. It's not BS that, the superior strategies could not have been developed had the inferior strategies not been developed first. That we owe a debt to the passive investing advocates that we have built on their work. And they're part of it. And I've always, frankly, said this. I'm just trying to say it more clearly. I've always said John Bogle's the godfather of rational investing. I've said that, many times. So the goal is to embrace the passive investing advocates without having to be dishonest, without having to say, oh, we embrace you, and at the, you know, the price of winning your embrace is that we say, oh, nothing wrong with giving the safe withdrawal rate wrong, that's fine, and no, that's not fine and dandy. That has to be fixed. So sort of a two-toned approach. Love and honesty. Love and courage. Charity and courage. Let me talk about that insight, because boy, am I hyped up about that. I don't know. I'd like to do a separate podcast. I've discussed the insight in earlier podcast, and I've been circling around on it. Now I think I've zeroed in on it pretty well, and I don't know if I can do a separate podcast on it right now. I just have to repeat it over and over again because it's so simple. Not that much can be said about it, but boy, the implications. It was a big thing when we discovered that the old school safe withdrawal rate studies got the numbers wrong. That was May 18th, 2002. We didn't have the total proof at that point, but, you know, I put the first post May 13th. John Russell put up a post where he did a sensitivity study of the old school studies and found that the sensitivity numbers were just awful. And that, you know, that didn't prove what the right numbers were, but it proved that the old school studies were not something anybody should be using to plan a retirement. That was day six. That in itself was huge. You know, that was our first huge insight. And we've had, I have an article at the site where I go through 20 of them, and I have one recently, 30 investment myths. But I mean, if you counted all the insights, it has to be in the hundreds today, you know, big and small. I think the biggest of all of them is this one that I've developed with input, always, please. John Walter Russell is just, you know, beyond belief. He's devoted his whole life to this in retirement. But as I say, not just that. I mean, people I've talked to on blogs, the people like, you know, Bernstein, Bogle, all that. I mean, obviously, I couldn't have done it without them. That's the point of this podcast. But with all this mixed together, we've generated this most recent insight, and it is at one time the most simple of all of them, painfully simple. I mean, I think there'll be a day when I look back at this and I'll just laugh. You call that an insight? You're like, oh, duh, the sky is blue, duh, you know. But the most profound, it frightens me, and I'm not an easily frightened guy. The insight that I'm talking about is one that I've explored. The idea here, and I think this is true, and it's tentative, please understand, it's tentative. I want more people to comment on it before I have full confidence in it, but I cannot find the flaw, personally, with my limited brain power. The idea, this most recent and most powerful insight is, and I think it changes the history of investing by itself, is that we all agree, there's a universal agreement that the long-term average return on stocks, U.S. stocks, is 6.5 real. Everybody acknowledges this. I believe if you took all the history we have, it would be 6% real. And the modern era, it's 6.5. So, you know, there's no law that says it's going to stay. It could go down to 6. It could go up to 7. But it's probably going to be somewhere in that neighborhood because you're talking about the whole U.S. economy, and a mature economy usually doesn't change that dramatically. So the return on stocks is somewhere in the neighborhood of 6.5 real. The passive model argues that this return is the result of market forces. That is, the way the model works is there's a certain return for giving up control of your money. So, for example, you know, I don't know, if you put your money in a certificate of deposit, you're giving up control of your money, and you get compensated for that. Let's just say that's 3%. I mean, I don't know. I don't care what the numbers are. I don't know, and I don't care. But it's much smaller than 6.5. Could be 2%. I guess. I think they usually use money markets, so it's lower. Maybe it's 2% real. It's a lower number. So that's, you know, just giving up control of your money. Then the theory goes that there's risk associated with stocks. Greater risk. And in order to get people to invest in stocks, they must be offered compensation, or they wouldn't be willing to do it. They would just say, hey, if they were only paid 2% in stocks, they'd say, I'm not going to go in stocks. There's more risk. I'm going to go with the money market. So to get them into stocks, you have to offer a reward, and that's called the equity risk premium. And the equity risk premium pushes the return up to 6.5, or at least historically it has. And there's no reason to think that would change going forward. There's no guarantee, but the default position is that that will stay roughly stable. And the passives agree with that. That's not under dispute. 6.5, the result of market forces. This most recent insight is, and it's the result of all the work we've done, very simple, but I think very profound, is that the 6.5 number is not the result of market forces. The 6.5 number is the result of the productivity of the U.S. economy. You see, what this points back to is when John Bogle developed the indexing revolution, when John Bogle started the indexing revolution by founding the Vanguard Fund Group, he revolutionized middle-class investing. And people don't appreciate what he did. People appreciate John Bogle. They think he's great. Millions do. But they don't appreciate how big a change this was. Because I would say there have always been two big risks to stock investing. One, the biggest risk of all was picking the right company. Because if you had to pick a stock, there were no indexes. So you had to pick a stock. And that's hard. And people like Warren Buffett are pretty good at it, but most of the rest of us are not so good at it and don't really care to do the work it would take to be good. So it was a huge risk. And if you pick the wrong company, you could lose everything. The company could go to zero. All your money gone. We tend not to think about it that way today because indexes are with us and we feel like, oh, if anybody takes on that risk of picking stocks, they're doing so voluntarily. Well, once upon a time, it wasn't voluntary. If you wanted to invest in stocks, that's the way it was, Buster. John Bogle changed that. He changed history. Because when you buy an index, you don't have to pick it. There's not going to be, the index is not going to go zero. Might go down, but it's not going to go to zero. The U.S. economy it could. But the odds of one company going to zero are much higher than the odds of the entire U.S. economy going to zero. So the biggest risk of stock investing was removed by John Bogle in the founding of Vanguard Group, creating index funds. That's history, but a history that I don't think is fully appreciated. The second big risk of stock investing is, now let's assume that one's done away with, that I think it's fine if people study companies that they invest in individual companies. But I think for the typical middle-class investor, it's better to invest in indexes because we don't want to spend the time to learn about the companies. So we avoid that risk. We just say, yeah, I'm not interested. I can get 6.5 in indexes. I don't need that. The second big risk is overvaluation. And that's, of course, the one that Bogle missed. When he advocated passive investing, he was saying, ignore overvaluation, invest in stocks regardless of price. Regardless of price. That's the second big risk of stock investing. And the valuation-informed indexing strategy eliminates that risk. And up until recently, I've been saying it diminishes that risk, not that it eliminates it. I've been saying, well, if the risk of stocks is sky high when the prices are where they were from 1996 through 2008. But I've been saying when stocks are reasonably priced, say we go to a P10 level of 15 or 14, the risk is greatly diminished. And if you look at the stock return predictor, you'll see that there's still some risk. But the risk is greatly diminished. The 10-year return, the worst 10-year return, I forget. I looked at it the other day. I forget now what it was. But the worst return, my recollection is, the worst return at 10 years, the worst return possible, going by the historical data, was, it was a positive number, but very small. It was like 0.3 or something. It was a tiny positive number. So the point was, in 10 years, you might not have much return, but you're not gonna lose much either. That's a worst-case scenario. The most likely return is somewhere around 6% real, but the worst case is, you'll break even. So that at that point, we had diminished risk dramatically. In other words, if you went with passive, you could have lost every, you know, you could have lost everything. I mean, you know, when you're investing at the price levels that applied from 96 to 2008, and the passives, they invest the same amount of stocks regardless of price. For them, the risk was sky high. You know, we had an 80% loss in the early 1930s, and that was from a P10 level much lower than what we hit in the late 1990s. So you could lose 80% of your money or more. Sky high risk. But taking valuations into account, you eliminate, you don't eliminate, but you diminish it greatly. You're down to a modest level of risk. Well, what if we take it the next step? What if we take it the next step? What if we not only limit our investing in stocks to times when prices are reasonable, what if we actually spread the word about how stock investing works? What if we tell people? What if we open the internet up to honest posting? We write books, we prepare calculators, we do all this sort of thing. Well, I am beginning to think we can not only diminish the risk of stock investing, we can virtually eliminate it. This is the magic of this insight. If the 6.5 number is set not by market forces, but set by the productivity of the U.S. economy, and that's what I have come to believe, that number is simply the long-term return of stocks, the average long-term return of stocks is always going to be whatever number is justified by the productivity of the U.S. economy. Because when you buy an index fund, you're buying a share of the U.S. economy. That's really what you're buying. You're not buying a company. So you don't have to take on risk to get that 6.5. It just is. It's just a mountain or an ocean. It just is. It's something that just is. You don't have to worry about these market forces and being compensated and all this sort of thing. Well, if that's true, and I think it is, then the natural return for stocks is not only 6.5 in 10 years or in 30 years. It's 6.5 in 1 year. In other words, what's happening is if the market were rational, then investors would incorporate all future news into the current stock price. Which means even at a time of a recession, when in the past we've seen stocks go down, they would not go down because people would see through that. They'd say, hey, you know, we're going to have a recovery. This recession's no big deal. In the long-term sense, it's meaningless. What's the return? 6.5. That's the rational return. That would be baked into the price. And you would get a 6.5 increase every year in real terms through recessions, through boom times, through everything. Now, the obvious question is, why don't we have that now? And the reason why we don't have it now is emotion. In other words, all stock risk, there's two kinds of stock risk. One is picking the right stock. We've eliminated that with index funds. The second type of risk is volatility. Volatility is solely the product of emotion. There is no rational need for any volatility. Volatility is the product of emotion. And all we have to do to eliminate the motion is provide people the tools, tools like the stock return predictor. What does the stock return predictor do? It tells people whenever prices start to go up that they have to sell. And of course, what does selling do? Brings the price back down. And it tells people whenever prices start to go down, the long-term return goes up, so you should buy more. And what does buying more do? Brings the price up. So what you do is you have a self-regulating stock price. The stock price, every time it starts to go up a little bit, if people have information on how stock investing works, it's then going to be pulled down. And every time it starts to go down a little bit, there's going to be information that's going to pull it up. The stock price will never be able to escape the fair value. It'll always be around 14, 15, which will always translate into a return of 6% real, something in that neighborhood. So we're not going to have to wait 30 years to get our safe 6.5 return. And we're not even going to have to wait 10 years. We can get it in 1 year, every year. Now, this is the ideal. This would mean, you know, we'd have to spend millions of dollars promoting rational investing. It's not going to happen by me saying it on a podcast. But if we can get the big hitters like Bogle and Bernstein and Burns and Clements and all the rest promoting rational investing, this is where it leads. And the even more exciting part, as if we need it anymore, is that when you get that 6.5 for stocks. That's essentially a risk-free return. There's no, the whole risk, I've discussed risk in several podcasts, and I've said that the proper way to look at risk is that risk is how long you have to give up your money, control your money. Well, if it's 6.5 return every year from stocks, there's not much risk in stocks. There's not much more risk than there is in a money market. There's some risk in both. The U.S. economy could collapse, and you wouldn't get, there's risk in a money market, and there's also risk in stocks. But if it's 6.5 every year, the risk in stocks is not really much greater than it is with a money market. You could take the money out anytime you want. You're not going to have this crazy volatility. What I'm saying is that volatility is optional. Volatility is a choice that we humans have made. We have made stocks volatile by encouraging people to invest passively, by telling people they don't need to worry about price. If we would only encourage people to take price into consideration, the market would self-regulate and volatility would disappear by itself. Volatility is optional. All right. So what I'm saying is people think of stocks as the riskiest asset class. You take away volatility and stocks aren't risky at all. They're no more risky than money markets. I know that what I'm saying is extraordinary, please. But you know, I'll take it back if you can explain to me where I'm wrong. But I have to say what I think. I did not go to stock school, understand. Do not manage a fund. I'm some guy who posts on the internet telling you what I think as the result of having thought about this stuff for, you know, 24/7 for 7 years now. All right, so we take away the risk. Say we take away the risk of stocks. And we keep the return. See, I was thinking all along that we would try to take away the risk, but I was thinking when we took away the risk, we would take away the return too, that the return of stocks was going to go down. But now I don't see any reason that has to be. You can have the 6.5 return and not have the crazy volatility, which means not have the crazy risk. It could be, you know, in almost every year 6.5, something close to that. If that's true, the other asset classes, the returns on certificates of deposit and I-bonds and TIPS and bonds and all these things, those returns are set by market forces. They're not set by the productivity of the U.S. economy. See, stocks sort of call the tune. Stocks establish the going rate. Stocks, the price is not set. There's no person who goes into a room and says, you know, like with the CD, the bank sets the rate. Or with TIPS, it's set by an auction. It's set by market forces. With stocks, it's set by the productivity of the country. So stocks set the tune. And the academics have been thinking all along that there's a risk premium, that the tune is set by the money market, which is a low rate, and stocks, the market sets the price higher because the risk is higher. But the rational approach is coming at it from the other end. It's saying, the stock price is set by economic realities, by the productivity of the economy, and the other asset classes, it's set by market forces, but there's not a risk premium, there's a risk penalty. That what's going on is these other asset classes can get away with paying less return because they are less risky because of the volatility of stocks. So in other words, the productivity of the economy is such that we all could get 6.5 for giving up control of our money. That's how much the money earns when it's put to use in corporate enterprises. But we're not given that much when we put it in a certificate of deposit. It's earning that wherever the money, I don't know where they put the money to use, but wherever it's put to use, presumably it's earning something in the neighborhood of 6.5 or else it's not being put to its best use. It's earning 6.5, but the owner of the CD doesn't get that amount. There's a middleman who's capturing it, the bank, capturing part of it. And then the buyer of the CD gets his portion. But there's a middleman taking a lot of it off. If we open up stocks to rational investing principles, there's no reason why that return shouldn't go up to close to 6.5. Right now, there's a risk penalty because they can get away with giving less because there are investors that want to escape stocks. They don't want the volatility of stocks, and they're willing to take a lower return. But the volatility is optional. So we can eliminate the volatility, And at that point, there's no reason for them to be willing to accept a lower return. So the return on things like CDs and I-bonds and tips should go up to somewhere close to 6.5. So says the theory. It's just a theory, but I'd sure like to discuss it with some smart people and see what some other people think. I'm sticking my neck out even saying it. It's so out there. I get that. But it sounds right to me. Now, the question people are going to ask is, where's the money come from? You know, if we're going to get 6 point real from CDs, that's a big change. Where's all the money come from? Well, the answer is these are market rates. The money obviously it is coming from somewhere. As I say, it's sort of coming from a middleman. But it's not like we're doing anything underhanded or anything or magical. What we're saying is the market rate return is 6.5. The money's being put to use. Whether you put it in a CD or in a money market or whatever else, it's being put to productive use somewhere. And in the U.S. economy, that's what the productive use rate is. Or at least that's what historically it has been. So that's what it should be. So there's nothing underhand it or magical about this. And the really important point is it's not just that that's what it should be in terms of the individual investor. That's what it should be in terms of the economy. In other words, when we are paying artificially low rates, we are hurting our productivity. It's market forces saying that that's what the rate should be. Now, some will say, well, if it's market forces saying that, then why doesn't it already happen? It doesn't happen because we don't have a free market setting prices today. We don't have a free market setting prices. If we had a, you know, if you look at what's involved in a free market, look on Wikipedia. I haven't looked at it, but I'm sure it says this. If you look under definitions, you know, explanations of Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand and laissez-faire capitalism and all this sort of thing. Part of what's involved is there has to be free transfer of information, or you don't have a free market. The participants in the market have to be informed. Well, in investing, they're not. You know, first of all, they don't have access to a stock return predictor. How could you possibly make an informed decision about stock investing if you don't even know what the price is? You don't even know what the return is you're going to get at the price level you're buying. The stock return predictor tells you that. But, you know, it's publicly available today, but it wasn't publicly available, you know, several years ago. And how many people know about my website today or John's website? So how many people really have a stock return predictor to guide their decision making? Not many. So the market is not functioning properly. And there's actually a negative. The market, you know, Motley Fool banned honest posting on safe withdrawal rates. Morningstar banned honest posting on safe withdrawal rates. Bogleheads.org banned honest posting on safe withdrawal rates. IndexUniverse.com banned honest posting on safe withdrawal rates. Early Retirement Forum banned honest posting on safe withdrawal rates. A number of blogs have banned it. So investors are not getting the information they need. It's being banned because it conflicts with the passive investing model. The realities of stock investing, the realities we learn by examining the historical data conflict with the dominant model of today, and that gets some people uptight. And so the information's been banned. But when the information is banned, the market doesn't function properly. So what I'm saying is let's open up the market. And I'm saying if we open up the market to proper functioning by allowing people to learn the realities, all these things follow. We can eliminate the risk of stock investing. You can't make a more dramatic statement than that in the personal finance field. You know, if you take the statement out of context, it sounds crazy. But if you look at the work we've done, it follows. I think it logically follows. And if you take out the risk of stock investing, I think you're going to increase the returns paid for what today are viewed as the less risky asset classes, because they no longer will be less risky. They'll be equally risky as stocks. And so they ought to be paying at least close to an equal return. So the middle class investor potentially could be earning far higher returns. He would be earning the same return in stocks, not a higher, But in real terms, he'd be earning a higher return because he wouldn't be jumping in and out. You eliminate the volatility and people won't be buying high, selling low anymore. They'll be actually earning the 6.5. And they won't have to wait 10 years for it or 30 years. They only have to wait 1 year. And on safer asset classes, they're going to do better. It's as out there as you can get. I don't know what to say. It's as out there as you can get. But I'm not going to drop the idea until somebody tells me why it's wrong. And as of today, I've taken these ideas everywhere I could. I've gone into the lion's den of, you know, places like Vanguard Diehards and Bogleheads where there are lots of passive investing advocates, dogmatics. And I've said, you know, find a flaw. I've gone to blogs and said, find a flaw. And frankly, nobody's done it. And so I need to have somebody point to a flaw to persuade me that this is wrong. Otherwise, I have an obligation to tell you about it. And I have an obligation to try to persuade John Bogle and others to help us make the case, help us publicize it. And anyway, I want to get on to the other part of the podcast where I extend the hand of friendship to these people because I want to work with them. This is where I see us going on a going forward basis is I'm going to try to create political pressure to get these people involved. I don't think they want to admit their mistakes. I think that's the driving force in all the friction we've seen, that the passive investing advocates don't want to admit their mistake. They don't want to acknowledge they got the model wrong. I don't think they understand, you know, a lot of the things we've come up with. They just haven't studied it the way we have. They're stuck in this passive investing model. I don't think they're bad people. But, you know, if you close your eyes and stick your fingers in your ears, you're not going to understand things. And they don't want to know. This is my take, and based on a lot of experience. And so we need to get their fingers out of their ears, and we need them to open their eyes. And so I don't want them to feel defensive. However, I don't want to say this isn't a big change, because it's a very big change. So I don't want to doctor the realities, you know. I don't want to come under false pretenses, but I do want to approach them, all passive investing advocates, in a spirit of friendship and warmth and love. And I think the best way to do that is to reach into the historical record and say, look, you did this. You know, a lot of it, you know, there's a saying where they say, oh, if the things we could accomplish if we didn't care who got the credit. Well, I would like my share of the credit. You know, I think I've played a role here, a significant role, and I do want my share of the credit. I think that's proper. I want John Russell to get his share of the credit. I want the entire retire early and indexing discussion board communities to get their share of the credit. But I want John Bogle to get a share of the credit. John Bogle's contribution today is underestimated, in Rob Bennett's opinion. John Bogle's a giant in the field. Everyone knows it. You know, possibly second only to Warren Buffett. And some would rate him higher. You know, they're up. They're the two giants. But Bogle's contribution is underrated. Because Bogle's contribution is what makes what I just talked about possible. We wouldn't be here today. So that's the idea in the podcast, and I probably should run through it now. I scribbled down some notes, but I don't know that they're all that important. But I'll go through them. But the type of thing. I'm going to give an example because this came up just today at a blog. It's a blog I like. It's called the Behavior Gap blog. Smart guy does it. And he had a blog entry today, and he was talking about the dangers of assumptions. In other words, if you make a bad assumption, the amount of the error can just multiply over the years, and it can turn into a real disaster. And that's true. That's a very valid point, very important point. But his take on it is that we shouldn't make assumptions. We should avoid assumptions. And boy, do I ever think that's a wrong-headed take. And he gave an example of safe withdrawal rates, you know, so naturally this drew my attention. And I said, look, I said, he was sort of saying, you know, his question at the end of the blog was, you know, why do we need to make assumptions? Why don't we just avoid making these assumptions? Because they can get us into such trouble. In other words, sort of think things through every year. Well, I think he's wrong, because the safe withdrawal rate idea, and I've seen a lot of people do this, a lot of people realize today the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are wildly wrong, and so what? They're sort of ashamed. They're embarrassed. You know, whenever the subject comes up at Bogleheads, they sort of, everybody gets quiet, you know. It's like somebody said something, you know, taboo. And but the safe withdrawal rate idea is wonderful. It's also ironic, but when I first started posting at Motley Fool, at you know, the board, the retire early community, I feel that I was the primary person who built it, made it big. But John Graney's the one who founded it. And I had to make a decision. This was back in May of 99. Should I start my own retire early community, or should I post at Graney, you know, the board that Graney founded? And I said, Graney, you know, I thought it was great. He had this website on early retirement, and he had... It was so great that he had this study on safe withdrawal rates. This is also comical looking back. But I thought it was great because I used safe withdrawal rate analysis to put my plan together. I just adjusted the numbers for valuations, and he didn't. But I didn't know that was going to be such a sticking point at the time. But what this fellow at Behavior Gap is suggesting is, oh, we really don't need safe withdrawal rate studies. You know, let's just every year sort of figure out how much we can take out. Well, no. Planning in personal finance is just critically important. I argued once that if you look at the distinguishing factors between people who retire early and people who don't, the primary distinguishing factor is that they are planners. If you plan, you win at this game of personal finance, at money management. If you don't plan, you get pushed by the waves and you never make great progress. Planning is everything. And you can't plan without making assumptions. That's why we make assumptions. It's not because we're stupid. It's not because we're goofballs. It's because planning, we have to plan ahead. We want to use money to live better lives. And so there's all kinds of decisions we have to make. There's all kinds of trade-offs. And to make them effectively, we need to plan. We need to say, okay, here's where I expect to be in 5 years, and here's where I expect to be in 10 years. And you have to change your plans to be sure. You can't get rigid. You know, that's probably his point, that you can't get rigid. And that's true. But the planning exercise itself has value. That's where you develop insights. That's how you learn. And so we have to plan. And safe withdrawal rate analysis is a wonderful way to plan. And what I said in my response, my comment was, it's not assumptions that are bad, it's wrong assumptions that are bad. What we need is to move away from this passive model, and we can develop safe withdrawal rate studies that work. Safe withdrawal rate studies that work are fantastic, and that's what the retirement risk evaluator is. Now, if somebody wants to say, Rob, I don't believe it, I don't think it's going to work, well, fine, that's healthy. That's healthy skepticism. If you don't think it's going to work. But give a reason. You know, don't put up some slime ball stuff. You know, give a reason. And if it's a good cautionary note, it helps people. So that, you know, you want to plan carefully. You don't want to just go for whatever somebody puts forward. But once we know that the methodology for the old school studies is analytically invalid, we should have dropped it and gone on to some other. But not to drop planning. And that's what this Behavior Gap guy is suggesting. And I think that's what a lot of people are thinking. In the wake of the stock crash, they're saying, you know, they're sort of saying passive investing doesn't work, but they don't want to acknowledge that passive investing's the problem. They're just saying, I'll get out of stocks. Well, stocks aren't the problem. Planning isn't the problem. Assumptions aren't the problem. The problem is passive investing. The problem is it's not true that valuations don't affect long-term returns. It's not true. So the point here is, what Bogle and all the other passive investing advocates did was they wrote a first draft. They were doing something very valuable. What they were doing for the first time in history was they were making investing, they were rationalizing it. Now, rationalizing can mean two things. Rationalizing can mean making it rational, and that's what they wanted to do. That's what they were trying to do. But what they ended up doing was the negative form of rationalizing. They were just, once they learned it was wrong and it didn't add up, they engaged in rationalizing, which means, you know, telling tall tales. You know, using your brain to come up with convoluted excuses. That's what passive investing has become since 1981, when Robert Shiller published his research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. It has become an exercise in rationalizing. And that's why you get all the meanness and the pettiness and the narrow-mindedness and the dogmatism and all this stuff. But that's not what it was intended to be. What it was intended to be was something beautiful, that we would take stock investing that was subjective, just a bunch of people giving their opinions, you know, taking shots at things, taking guesses. I think stocks are gone up. No, I think they're gone down. It was all BS, basically. And they were turning to academic research to make it a serious subject, an objective pursuit. And that's what I'm trying to bring it back to. I'm saying, wait a minute, that original plan was wonderful. We blew it. In 1981, when Shiller came, see, what happened was sort of a trick of history. Shiller came out with his research in 81, which showed if valuations affect long-term returns, there's no way that passive could ever work. It's impossible for the human mind to even figure out how that could happen. But in 81, my sense of things is they had already spent a lot of money marketing it. And the marketing was going well. People liked this. People liked this idea of a rational approach to investing. So they didn't want to admit it was wrong. And the killer was stock prices were so low that stocks were fated in 81 when Shiller came out with his research to zoom over the next 20 years. There was no getting around it. So any strategy that got people heavily into stocks was going to pay off big for the next 20 years. It had nothing to do with whether the strategy was good or bad or smart or dumb or analytically valid or not. And so they had a winner on their hands. They had a winner. People loved it. And the historical data said it couldn't miss for 20 years. And humans tend not to look beyond 20 years. You know, most of us are concerned about what's going to happen next week, next month, next year. And so they did what John Craig suggested at the Vanguard Diehards. They engaged in some white lies. They told themselves, well, maybe, you know, maybe it's not, maybe the market's not perfectly efficient, you know, but that Shiller guy, he might have made some mistakes. You never know. We made some mistakes and we're smart and maybe he made some mistakes. You never know. And people are scared. They're very scared to get into stocks. And if we encourage them, well, they'll get into stocks, and it'll be good for them. It'll help them. And we're dealing with academic research. And, you know, they told themselves all kinds of stories, and they believed them. For the most part, they believed them, I believe. Appears to me. They said, yeah, we're not doing anything that bad. But, of course, as time went on, something that the white lies turned into dark, black, ugly lies by the mid-90s, when stocks were scary as all get out, and they were telling people, hey, you know, stocks for the long run, buy and hold, timing doesn't work, stay the course. Now, they've caused the greatest loss of middle-class wealth in the history of the United States. You're going to say, hey, oopsie. So that's where we are. What we need to do, we need to come together as a society and, you know, yes, we need to say oopsie. You know, it obviously needs to be more serious than that. We need to have on the cover of Money Magazine, John Bogle, I was wrong. And he should explain what happened. And then the next month, Bill Bernstein. And then the next month, Scott Burns. And the next month, Jonathan Clemens. On and on. Next month, Motley Fool, you know, whoever it happens to be. We all need to step forward. Next month, Rob Bennett. You know, what did I get wrong? Well, here are some things. I just listed them. I'll go through them quickly. I thought it was only Graney. There was a time when I thought John Graney was the problem. John Graney was this horribly abusive poster at Motley Fool, and I thought, why don't they kick John Graney off the board? He's destroying our board. Because I had lots and lots of people saying they were very interested in learning the realities. And John Graney was threatening to kill people. And I said, why don't they remove this guy? But I've learned, to my chagrin, it's not just John Graney. You know, it's not. John, All is forgiven. Not really. Now, it wasn't only John Graney. I mean, obviously he didn't help, and he's not helping today. But it wasn't only John Graney. There were others. Lots of others. Lots and lots and lots of others. Two, I thought it was only safe withdrawal rates. I thought all we had to do was prove that the safe withdrawal rate numbers were wrong, and all this was going to go away. And I remember writing to Scott Burns, and I told him, I said, look, the safe withdrawal rate numbers are wrong. And Scott sent me an email back saying, hey, you're right. And I thought, hey, we've solved it. This was years ago. I don't know how many years ago now. Probably 4 years ago. I thought, hey, it's all over. It's all over. But Scott had second thoughts. I think he realized, you know, and then, of course, he wrote a column saying that the media is not going to tell us about the errors in the safe withdrawal rate studies because, quote, it is information most people don't want to hear. You see? They have learned that there are certain things that we want to hear, which is all the get-rich-quick stuff, and there's certain things we don't want to hear. So they turned what was a science into an anti-science. Science is telling people the truth, whether they want to hear it or not. Marketing is telling people what they want to hear. What's happened is marketing has come to dominate. But I didn't do this podcast to rail against passive investing. The point was, it was not only the point of this listing here is to say things I was wrong about. You know, we all need to say what we were wrong about because that's healthy. That's healing. And I was wrong in thinking it was only Graney. I was wrong in thinking it was only safe withdrawal rates. It was a lot bigger than I ever realized. I once believed in passive investing, point three. Well, I did. They once put a gun to my head and said, you have to tell us what you think the optimal allocation is. And I said, 50%. I didn't know. But I was clearly wrong. During those years of insane prices, the best allocation was something in the neighborhood of 20%, according to the historical data. Five, I believed in the equity risk premium. You can see that on a podcast. I have one where I talk about the equity risk premium, and now I'm saying there is no equity risk premium. There's a non-equity risk penalty is what's really going on, I believe, today. So I was wrong. I can write, an article for the cover of Money Magazine, Rob Bennett, I was wrong. And I hope that would help the healing process move forward. I thought risk equaled return. I bought that idea. That's probably the single idea that's caused the most trouble, that taking on risk adds to your return. But I'm now saying no. Stocks don't provide a high return because they're more risky. They just provide a high return because they give you a share of U.S. productivity. And U.S. productivity is enough to generate 6.5 real. It's got nothing to do with being willing to take on risk. Risk is voluntary. We've chosen to make stocks risky by not informing ourselves about the realities. We've chosen this. We've chosen this pain, just like a drunk chooses to ruin his life and his marriage and his job. We have chosen to ruin stock investing by encouraging the promotion of passive/emotional ideas about how to invest. I thought the experts knew more than they did, point seven. I've lived in all the experts. I don't live in all of them today. I respect them. I feel affection for them, but I do not live in all of them. I've seen them make too many mistakes for that. Number eight, I let big words and big numbers intimidate me. That's a problem middle-class investors really have, that they see people use big words and big numbers and they let it intimidate them. They give up their common sense. Don't ever give up your common sense. Nine, I found the idea that corporate sites would ban someone just for reporting the retirement numbers accurately to be absolutely impossible to believe. John Graney threatened to have me banned from Motley Fool. I thought it was impossible that somebody would be banned who had never once put forward an abusive post. But I was wrong. Graney was right. I'm just pointing out things I was wrong about, just to say that we're all wrong about different things. We're all wrong. We're all affected by what's going on in the society at large. We're all affected by our fellow community members. We all are subject to social pressures. And we create belief systems that are sometimes fundamentally flawed. I thought stocks were risky. Number 10. Today, I don't really think that. I think the risk is optional. The risk is something we choose. I at least tentatively think that. I wanted to point out in this podcast that I learned from all of the passive investing leaders, Bogle, Bernstein, Kitsis, Scott Burns, Jonathan Clements, the Diehards Board, the Bogleheads Board, Motley Fool, Mel Kale, Siegel, and Stocks for the Long Run. I learned from every one of those people. I learned from every one of those people. I got to say it over and over again. I learned from every one of those people. Thank you. Thank you. We had this big thread at the nofeeboards.com. It's now defunct, but it was incredible. There have been so many incredible threads, God knows, but this one was so off the wall nuts. The thank you controversy. God, it was insane. Wanderer, who was a friend of mine, a personal friend. I mean, he was a friend from discussion boards, but we met personally. We had lunch. And, I put up some kind of post, and he's like, why should we thank you, Rob? You know, and I was like, I said, look, if you don't want to thank me, don't thank me. But I do think thanks are called for here, given that I started this discussion, and look at what we've come up with. I think a thank you would be appropriate. And he said, I've done X and I've done Y and I've done Z. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I said, you're great. You're fantastic. You're my favorite community member. I said, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I put bold and italics. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And he's still angry. That thread, I don't know. I don't know if that's around anymore. I think I have it in my files, but I don't think it's publicly available. But what an incredible thing. A big factor is jealousy. People feel, oh, Rob is coming up with things we didn't come up with. Well, jealousy is the work of the devil. Wanderer played a big role in this. And this is the biggest stuff in my lifetime. So Wanderer should be in on it. And John Russell and I invited John Graney to help develop the new methodology for safe withdrawal rates. So John Graney should be in on it. They all should be in on it. Bogle should be in on it. There's room for thousands here, people. Nobody's trying to grab credit. There's room for thousands. It's all good. It's all good. So then I had a list of things that the passives I'm going to need to work on shutting down here, but a list of some things that passives brought to the table. It is objective. Passive investing brought in the idea that our investing strategy should be rooted in something objective, rooted in the historical data. That was breakthrough. They got it wrong. I think because of the personality type. The personality type that came up with the idea of making it objective is the personality, the engineering, personality type, accounting, and they don't tend to think about the human side. And so they didn't think about it. They ignored it. And that meant all their numbers were wrong. I mean, it was unfortunate. But look, it happens. So what those of us who know they got it wrong need to do is, we need to reach out to them. We don't need to put them down, but we do need to point out that they're wrong. You see? We have to walk that line. So we have to reach out. We have to extend the hand of friendship while, saying, look, there do need to be changes. There do need to be changes. It is humble, I say. Is passive investing humble? In its original incarnation, I think that was the intent. The idea of not picking stocks. Indexing is not the same thing as passive investing. Indexing is diversification. Passive investing is not changing your allocation. But the ideas have been connected in the minds of many passive investing advocates, and there is a humility there. The idea that you don't need to pick the stock, and the idea that you don't need to know when to change your allocation. There's sort of a hint of humility there, which is healthy. The problem is it's a humility that turned into arrogance. They started out saying, oh, well, I'm going to do this because I don't know. That was the way they phrase it. Oh, I'm not so smart, But then it turned into, I'm not so smart, but anybody who doesn't do it is dumb. Anybody who does different than me is dumb. Mel Lindauer would say, we need to protect the newbies from what the historical data says. That's not humble. So it started out with humility. Humility is there, and we need to recognize that. We need to give the passive investing advocates credit for the humility that is there while noting that humility has turned very sour. It is indexing related. Passive investing is not indexing. It's not the same thing. But indexing is part of it, and the indexing part is wonderful. As I said earlier, people don't even appreciate today how much of a contribution Bogle made by bringing in indexing. That was just a revolution. because we never could have, you know, if we're talking about eliminating the risk of stock investing, which is what I'm putting on the table, I'm not going to make strong declarative sentences. Well, I've made them, but I'm not going to overdo it, I hope. But, you know, it appears to me that that's where things are headed. And that couldn't have been done without indexes. You could not accomplish what I'm talking about, eliminating the risk of stock investing with individual stocks. It had to be with indexes because stock returns are not predictable with individual stocks. It's only when you do an index that it becomes predictable because you eliminate this potential of the company failing or booming. When you average it all out by doing a broad index, you average out some companies do great, some do medium, some do poor. And when you mix them all together, you get the productivity of the U.S. economy. You don't get that purchasing Apple computer. You don't get the productivity of the U.S. economy. So it's indexing that took some of the complexity of stock investing off the table so that we could focus in on these realities that we've developed in the retire early and indexing discussion boards over the past 7 years. It is pro-stock. One of the great contributions of the passive investing model is that it is very much a pro-stock model. And I think that's great. Stocks, I believe, are the ticket to financial freedom for the middle-class investor. A lot of people are scared of stocks today. They're running away from stocks, and I think they should be running the other way. What I'm saying, you know, in this podcast and in some others is stocks are not even risky. They're not even necessarily riskier than other asset classes. We make them risky. Risk is optional. Well, if that's true, then we all should be pro-stock. We all should be encouraging middle-class people to invest primarily in stocks, and the way to do that is to shoot straight with them, and the way to do that is to diminish the risk. So the passive investors want to encourage stock investing. Unfortunately, they're going about it in the worst way by making stocks 10 times more risky than they need to be. But if they'll just give up that part of the project, then, you know, we're on common ground. Passive investing put the emotional dark side on full display. You know, I don't want to go on and on about that because that goes against the thrust of the podcast. But if you look at what, you know, if you look at the campaign of terror against our board communities, you see some ugly stuff. And ugly stuff underlines the point that emotions matter, that stock investors are defensive. They're scared. They're scared little boys and girls, really. Maybe that's the best way to say it. We're all scared little boys and girls. And passive investing became a model that is about denial of that reality. And what a mistake that was. But we couldn't have learned what not to do without the passive investors taking it to the limit. Investing has always been emotional, but I think it would be fair to say that passive investing is more emotional than any other approach. And we should ask why. Why is that? Why is that? It's because it's all numbers. You see, that bringing in the numbers was huge. It was a huge contribution. That was great. It made investing objective because until then, it was all just opinion and it makes your head spin. You listen to one expert, he says A. You listen to another one, he says the opposite. You don't know what to do. Bring in the numbers and you've got something objective. Well, bring in only the numbers and not the emotions and you've got something pig-headed and pretentious and pompous and arrogant and unyielding and abusive. And fearful and angry and hateful. See, it's a delicate balance we need to strike. Yes, we need the objective side, and we need to be grateful for the people who develop passive investing for bringing that front and center. But they also, a second thing they showed us is the danger of putting all your chips on the numbers, because that's the road to madness. There's a quote from Chesterton that I intend to have as the epigraph for the book I'm writing. I don't recall it exactly, but essentially what he said was, the madman is not the man who has abandoned his reason. The madman is the man who has abandoned everything but reason. That's what makes you insane. And we, you know, we now can demonstrate that with the post archives. You know, we've got records. We've got records, and we shouldn't look at those records for the purposes of embarrassing people, but we should look at them for the purpose of learning. I believe that. It is academic based. I mean, the importance of that point is, I've often pointed out how I think the ruin of passive investing was this focus on marketing. They allowed marketing considerations to become dominant. But by going to the academic research, that would sort of cut that marketing off, if only it had been done properly, the considerations. Well, I'll close with a little thought from a blog, the Four Pillars blog. And they had a blog entry there yesterday called Gray, and it was a good point. The guy wrote it. I think his name is Mr. Cheap, and he argued that he was talking about bloggers. He told a good story about one blogger who wrote him a very gushing, positive comment. Oh, you're great. He's comparing him to Shakespeare or something. And then this woman found out that I don't know, he advocated something she didn't like, and it came back with this scathing stuff. And he says, "I'm not as good as she thought I was when she was saying I was good, and I'm not as bad as she thought I was when she thought I was bad." And boy, is that true to life. That's the way it really is. And so passive investing is not as bad as we may think it is when we're suffering a bust at retirement, and it's not as good as we thought it was when, the insane bull market was raging and we were giving credit to passive investing for these insane returns we were earning. What it is a first cut at a rational investing model. The passive investing model is the first cut. And what I said in my comments at that blog entry, I said, he concluded, he said, "Well, absolutes, there are no absolutes." And I said, "Well, I don't know about that. There are absolutes. 2 + 2 = 4. There are absolutes." I said, the problem, it's not that there are not absolutes. The problem is we humans have a tendency to think we possess knowledge of the absolutes, and a lot of times we don't because we are flawed creatures. The problem is not that there are not absolutes. The problem is we are too confident that we possess knowledge of the absolutes. So what we all need to do is we need to say what we believe. And there are people who believe in passive investing today, and I have said this many times. I'll say it again. They need to continue to say that for as long as they believe it. Because that's their role. That's how they are constructive. They keep the rest of us honest. They express skepticism about some of these wild ideas I put forward. And we need that. If we don't have that, we'll just go off the rails. But they need to acknowledge that, hey, Rob Bennett doesn't possess absolute truth, neither does John Bogle. We both, John Bogle started out as a little boy. Rob Bennett started out as a little boy. We're trying to come up with good models, and John Bogle got an awful lot right. He revolutionized middle-class investing. He got one very important thing very, very wrong, I believe. And if he didn't get it wrong, well, that will come out in the discussions. If we hold a national debate about the errors, the flaws of the passive investing model, it will come out. If he got it right, it will come out. If he got it wrong, that will come out. If he got it wrong, he needs to back down. He needs to fix the error. We need to take this in a positive direction. So the answer is not to deny the existence of absolutes, I don't think. But the answer is tolerance for different viewpoints. The answer is to be able to believe in your own head that something is true while accepting your own limitations and knowing, and the good side of that is it takes such a weight off your shoulders. You don't have to live in fear that your mistakes are going to be uncovered. Once your mistakes are public, what did Dylan say? And like a Rolling Stone, you're invincible now. You have no secrets to conceal. You're invisible now, I think it was. You're invisible now. You have no secrets to conceal. That's where we need to invite the passives, and that's where we need to stay ourselves. We need to not get big heads ourselves. And that's why I say I think for all of us it would be a positive exercise to acknowledge whatever mistakes we're aware of, and our fellow community members can point out those that we don't see, and we should shake their hands and be their friends for doing so, because they're helping us by doing so. So I said when I talked about attending the Bogleheads meeting, I said the first thing I'm going to do, I had some people welcoming me, and they said, "Hey, Rob, we're going to see the devil in person, live and in person, with hooves and tail and pitchfork." And I said, "Yeah." And I said, the first thing I'm going to do when I walk in the door is I'm going to say, "Where's Mel?" Look for Mel Lindauer, and walk across the room and shake his hand. So I extend my hand again to Mel and to all my friends on the passive investing side of the tracks. Without an acknowledgement that any of the rational, any of the valuation-informed indexing strategies are wrong. I believe they're right. And I'll stand for them, and I'll defend our community, and I will argue for our right to post at all boards at which passive investors congregate. I think we have a right to post the realities. I believe we have a responsibility to post the realities. I believe we all should be working together to pull this economy out of its crisis that it's in today. As friends. And part of that is going to mean, I believe, the passives are going to have to acknowledge that certainly that we got some things right. Certainly we got the safe withdrawal rate right. But I think a lot else, a lot beyond that. And we are going to have to acknowledge that we could have never done it without the incredible contributions of the, you know, thousands and thousands of people who have contributed to the first draft of the rational investing model of stock investing that was called passive investing. Good luck with your investing strategies.